You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 34th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 18th to Sunday, July 20th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, the oldest continual free jazz festival west of the Mississippi River. This year, Friday night will be a blues night featuring the Roseland Hunters, and the rest of the festival features jazz performers Farrell Newton plus Soul 3, the Portland Youth Jazz Orchestra, the Mel Brown Septet, Devin Phillips, and many more. Again, that's the 34th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, located in Cathedral Park under the St. John's Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Welcome to Occupy Radio. I'm Jimmy Tardy. Today we are going back to the Occupy the Media Podomatic.com podcast set. They are hosting six shows now that are produced around the country as part of the Occupy the Airwaves radio effort. Today we're going to be listening to Clearing the Fog Radio. This is Dr. Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeiss. Today they're going to be speaking with Janelle Cornwell, author of a new book called Building Cooperative Power: Stories and Strategies from Worker Cooperatives in the Connecticut River Valley, and Ajoa Ifateo, who has extensive experience studying and creating cooperatives. Again, this is Occupy Radio. Today we're going to be hearing from Clearing the Fog Radio. That's Dr. Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeiss. And we're going to go to that now.
Saying when they think you cannot hear, if you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear, if you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse, if you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeiss.
And good morning after this holiday weekend. We posted a number of articles this weekend. It was July 4th, Independence Day. And on popularresistance.org, we posted a number of articles, including, I think, a speech by Frederick Douglass in 1852, I believe it was, at Seneca Falls or somewhere in Massachusetts. Anyway, number of articles talking about kind of the state of where we are and the whole independence and who has liberty and who has freedom. I think it's important for us to think about these things during the holiday times.
It seems like there's a lot of misinformation about U.S. history, so it's 4th of July is a good opportunity to rethink that and look at some truths about things we don't like to talk about.
Like the state of democracy in the United States. And so we kicked off this...
Like the state of lack of democracy.
Exactly. So do you want to talk about the Rolling Rebellion real quickly?
Rolling Rebellion, www.rollingrebellion.org, Rolling Rebellion for Real Democracy. It's an ongoing project that started on the 4th, and there was a great event, couple great events on the 4th that are worth mentioning. One was in New Mexico, where the activist float got the top prize for most patriotic, which was great to see, and they had all sorts of activists listed on flags, and they had big puppets of historical leading figures, Harriet Tubman, and current people like Amy Goodman and others. And they got top prize for most patriotic, which is pretty cool. In Venice, California, there was another 4th of July march where became a very anti-war, anti-corporate group that got a lot of cheers from the crowd. So there's, you know, we see that happening all over the country, people doing that kind of thing and using the 4th of July to get out a different message about what kind of changes are needed. You can go to rollingrebellion.org or just go to popularresistance.org to get updated on what's going on there. We'll be putting out updates as they happen. And if you haven't developed an event, please go to the map on rollingrebellion.org and either sign up one that already exists or create one. It can be something as simple as a public reading of the Declaration of Independence or, some kind of a teach-in or a small protest at a corporate power at a federal government building or something. So there's all sorts of opportunities to do stuff to show your part that there is a democracy movement developing in this country.
Right. And on that note, we did participate in a protest at the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, last Tuesday, July 1st. And there are 8 days left in the public comment period to save the Internet, to protect net neutrality and prevent discrimination. And so go to popularresistance.org and find out about how you can do that.
FCC.gov/comments and demand that the Internet be classified as a public utility, a common carrier, where there can be no discrimination. Everybody has equal access to the Internet, not based on wealth or, a tiered Internet based on how much money you pay. So we want to, keep it net neutral. And the way to do that is to reclassify it as a common carrier. And that's what you should be demanding at fcc.gov/comments. We have a great video up on popularresistance.org of that protest, a 2-minute video. Margaret's an angel in the video. And I am the Comcast. I'm a fat cat Comcaster. And we have some other fat cats and people-powered events and a devil and all sorts of cool stuff. So check it out at popularresistance.org.
That's right. And then just one other quick plug before we get in with our important show. On July 21st in Washington, D.C. at Bus Boys and Poets at the 5th and K Street location, beginning at 7 p.m., we're going to be holding an event called America's Secret Fukushima. You may remember that we traveled to South Dakota in April around Earth Day to tour the abandoned uranium mines and learn more about their impact and launch a campaign to clean them up. And so we'll be showing video and speaking more about that on July 21st. It's a Monday evening at Bus Boys and Poets. So let's get on with our show because we're going to be talking about a very important issue this morning, developing a cooperative economy. And we have two wonderful guests. We're going to start out with Janelle Cornwell. She's co-author of a new book, Building Cooperative Power, Stories and Strategies from Worker Cooperatives in the Connecticut River Valley. She's also a professor. Good morning, Janelle.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. Can you start out just by telling our listeners about the book?
Sure. The book is coming out now, and it's, as you said, the title is Building Cooperative Power, Stories and Strategies from Worker Cooperators in the Connecticut River Valley. It takes three approaches to talking about the cooperative economy, focusing really on worker cooperatives, which is the smallest sector of cooperatives in the U.S. So it takes sort of a practical approach in the first section with how-tos and a history of worker cooperatives in the region, and then it moves on to highlight 10 profiles of worker cooperatives in our region. And then the third section is really about the movement and its invisibility historically, and then overcoming the challenges in building a cooperative economy in the Connecticut River Valley region.
Very cool. So this is Kevin. Thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your taking the time.
Hi, Kevin.
Let me ask you, what made you write this book, you and your co-authors, write this book now? Do you think there's a moment here that is important? Why is this the moment to have this book come out?
Well, I think a lot of people are extremely frustrated with the state of the economy and sort of our vulnerability with reference to the economy. And cooperatives really put the model of capitalism on its head so that it puts capital in service of people as opposed to people in service of capital, so that people can have a say in the decisions that affect their economic lives. So I think that this is a perfect moment for the book to come out, and I hope to see many others like it, because there really is a solution at hand, people working in this way already and people building more cooperatives for the future, both worker cooperatives, consumer cooperatives, producer cooperatives. People in the U.S. don't even know the difference between those sectors by and large. So education is a big, important part of this movement, and I think it's a great time for it to come out.
And that's one of the things I really liked about the book, is it just, it really laid it out there in simple terms for people who are kind of new to learning about the cooperative economy. You know, what exactly cooperatives are, why they're beneficial. Maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of the cooperative economy that already exists compared to the kind of the capitalist economy, kind of the scale of it here and around the world, and why, you know, kind of, or how it does, how the cooperative economy compares to the capitalist economy.
Sure. Thanks, Margaret. So sort of the bigger picture of cooperatives worldwide is that there are some about a billion members of cooperatives worldwide, and they employ approximately 200 million people. And that, you know, in scope is 20% more than multinational corporations employ. So, and in the U.S., and these numbers are coming from ICA statistics, that's the International Cooperative Alliance. In the U.S., approximately one in four people are members of cooperatives. And so if you zoom back, the movement is really quite huge. A lot of the products that we buy come from cooperatives, even if we don't know it. For example, Cabot cheese, Welsh's grape juice, things like this are actually produced by farmers who are part of a producer cooperative. So... the difference, though, within the cooperative economy is that there are three sectors, three main sectors, consumer, producer, and worker cooperative sectors. And there's also some companies, cooperative companies, that are hybrids of one or two or more of those groups. So the consumer cooperative sector is made up of consumers, and they're like food cooperatives, credit unions, things like that. Producer cooperatives are... cooperatives of producers getting together to market their product or add value to it, like Land O'Lakes, for example, Sunkist, and worker cooperatives. They're members who get together to own their workplaces together and govern their workplaces together. And that's really the focus of the book, is worker cooperatives. It's currently the smallest sector worldwide. The fewest cooperatives are worker cooperatives, especially in the U.S.
And this seems like a great time to be talking about worker cooperatives, because we certainly have an employment problem. And it looks like it's going to be a long-term employment problem. And then I'm not sure, though, you know, with robotics and other changes in the economy, I'm not sure we're going to see enough jobs for everybody. So people need to figure out new ways to create jobs. And it seems like the history of cooperatives, and it's been a long history, and your book points out some cooperatives going back to the mid-1800s in your region. It seems like the history of cooperatives ebbs and flows with the economy. I mean, as the economy gets weaker and workers need to find new work or create new jobs, it grows. So we seem to be at a point of growth at this point. Is that how you see it?
Definitely. In many regions of the world, you can see that cooperative sector expand as the capitalist economy contracts. And it's definitely a means, not only do cooperatives stand up with more strength in times of crisis, but it's also a time when people get together and figure out solutions on their own.
Right, and that, I think that's kind of inherent to the cooperative model, is that one of the ways it differs from kind of the capitalist business model, in which, you know, everything is about profit, and if your profits are going down, there's no problem with cutting, you know, workers loose or moving to a new area where you can get lower labor or, you know, cheaper resources. The cooperative model is different because it's the worker owners working together to sustain themselves through difficult times, and they have more flexibility, I guess, to do that. Maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of one way that cooperatives really differ from kind of capitalist enterprises is the value systems that cooperatives use.
Sure, yeah. The cooperative principles and values are really the thing that unites cooperatives across sectors and across industries. And they really come out of a long history of cooperation, cooperatives in that is worldwide. You can look them up online on the International Cooperative Alliance's website. Look up cooperative values and principles. But basically, they are a set of values or a set of principles that can be used to help govern any kind of cooperative. And they're based on one member, one vote. They're based on democracy, transparency, these kinds of things that are necessary to carry out businesses in a cooperative way. Because if you don't have the profit as the guiding logic of your business, what are you going to use to govern and to make your business function and be financially viable?
So what is the guiding principle? If it's not profit, what is it? How would you define it?
Well, there are several cooperative. Hold on one second.
I guess the overarching one would be, I guess, that is to creating kind of sustainable businesses that are the whole. I guess they really differ is the fact that they're transparent, they're accountable, they're run democratically, they're more rooted in their communities and rooted towards
creating
things,
jobs for workers.
Creating jobs, but also educating.
Yeah.
You know, there's more. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I would say the overarching principle is that cooperatives exist to serve the members, not necessarily for profit. It's important to be financially viable, but the purpose of the businesses themselves is to serve their members. So depending on which sector of cooperative, whether you're a consumer sector, producer, or worker, you're going to have different needs. So for worker cooperatives, the purpose of the cooperatives is not only to sell the product that they're making or provide the service to their community, but to provide work for their members.
Right.
So that is the very purpose of the existence. So if you look in places like in Argentina, in the crisis of 2001, 2002, the economy absolutely collapsed. Businesses were closing down. And the workers began taking over. I'm sure you guys have heard of the worker-recovered factories and businesses in Argentina.
Right.
The workers began taking these businesses over and running them themselves because their need was for work. And people really associate that movement with the crisis. However, since then, in the last 3 years alone, some 63 worker-recovered enterprises have formed. So it's still happening. The crisis of capitalism is ongoing, even if it isn't for the macro picture. It's happening on a very small scale. And so workers there are taking over their businesses. And here in the U.S., and in many places, we have worker cooperatives working to secure employment for their members and even associating to grow the sector for other people who also need jobs.
Great.
Yeah, that's very exciting. We have to take a quick break.
Yeah, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about how cooperatives are linking with each other and forming regional, local and regional cooperatives of cooperatives. And I want to also talk about how we can really, you know, change this economy to a more cooperative one in a broader way. And so the capitalist system is not the dominant one. So that would be something I want to explore a little bit with you as well. So those kind of topics when you come back.
Right. And so we're going to go into this break with a song by one of our favorite musicians, Ann Feeney, and it's called The Corporate Welfare Song.
You're listening to WEAT Radio, WPWC 1480 AM. Now get out there and do something.
They've been picking every pocket here from sea to shining sea. We must intervene to break this cycle of dependency. ADM and Cargill, General Motors, Ford and Boeing, ITT and Lockheed, and that welfare line keeps growing, growing, growing. Now Congress says we can't afford to subsidize the needy. But before we slash the safety net, let's tell the truly greedy. We're gonna end welfare as we know it and get those greedy chiselers off the dole. We're gonna end welfare as we know it. Teach them a little self-control. For far too long we've allowed these corporate hawks to belly up to the public trough. No more welfare.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeeson, that was Ann Feeney criticizing the corporate welfare that we see so widely in the country.
That's
at a time when the jobs are needed and the economy's collapsing, the welfare keeps going to the corporations.
That's right. Our guest this morning is Janelle Cornwell, and she's a co-author of Building Cooperative Power, Stories and Strategies from Worker Cooperatives in the Connecticut River Valley. And I think I just want to put this in the context of, you know, building cooperative power is something that is growing. There's this whole solidarity, democratic economy that's growing around the world. It's growing in the United States. It's exciting to see, especially just this year alone. It feels like there's been a huge explosion of, there was a conference in Jackson, Mississippi in May that was followed by our conference in Baltimore, the mid-May, and then in June, the Common Bound conference in Boston. So people
and lots of cities are caught learning from the Evergreen model in Cleveland, and many cities are moving in that direction and finding anchor institutions that can be served by people's cooperatives or worker cooperatives. And so there seems to be a lot bubbling up right now. So this book's really well timed.
It is very timely. In New York, just I guess they're putting some capital towards cooperative investment. So this is really exciting, and this new book, Building Cooperative Power, really lays it out for people that are new to this or people that are in cooperatives. It helps you to see how other cooperatives are faring and overcoming the obstacles that face some of the cooperatives. So with that, Janelle, sorry to talk so long. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what is happening in the cooperative community to build these alliances and start to really further develop the cooperative economy?
Sure, definitely. Well, one place to start, if people are interested, and this goes back to the question Kevin asked earlier about the principles, if you go to ica.coop, you can see a list of 7 principles in the cooperative identity. That's a really good resource for people to go and see what's happening sort of at a global level, the International Cooperative Alliance, that is. And that's one thing that's going on to connect cooperatives of all industries, of all sectors, across economies worldwide. At a smaller or sort of a more regional level in the U.S., we've got the National Cooperative Business Association. That's a cross-sector association. We also have within the worker cooperative sector, we have the United States Federation of Worker Cooperatives. And then sort of scaling down a bit more, there are several regional associations, and one of those that I'm most familiar with, obviously, because the book is about it, is the Valley Alliance of Worker Cooperatives, and that's located in western Massachusetts in the Connecticut River Valley. That's southern Vermont and in northern Connecticut as well.
Let's explore that last one a bit, because when we had our conference in Baltimore, we had a series on co-ops, and one of the things that came out of that series was a discussion by the people who were doing some cooperatives. There were about a half dozen or maybe 8 cooperatives represented in the room. And it was talking about how do we ally with each other and build this cooperative movement. And so how did that cooperative in the Valley begin, and how did it grow? Go through that process.
And what does it do?
And then, what does it do? Sure.
Sure, definitely. Well, it really started off as a conversation in one of the conferences, Eastern Conference for Workplace Democracy, I think in 2005. A few people from different worker co-ops got together. They were interested in talking to each other, and they decided to begin meeting monthly in 2005 to see what they could build together. And slowly but surely, they contacted other worker cooperatives in the region, and they continued to meet monthly. And within a few years, they had outlined a vision, objectives, and a mission for the organization. They began paying dues, and in 2010, they formalized as a cooperative of worker cooperatives. And one of the ways that they were able to sort of identify as cooperatives among each other was as worker cooperatives. However, seeing themselves as part of a broader movement of cooperatives has really been helped by identifying with the international cooperative values and principles. And doing that has helped them, as VOC, the Valley Alliance of Worker Cooperatives, connect with other sectors like the neighboring Food Cooperative Alliance, which is in the same region, it's association, not alliance, in the same region, a cooperative or an association of food cooperatives, and there are some 30 in the region. And comparatively in size, the food cooperatives are obviously much larger. They represent an annual revenue of somewhere around $225 million. The worker cooperatives in the Valley region the Valley of Work Alliance of Worker Cooperatives has about 7.5 million in revenue, and they employ about 70 people. And their allies in the neighboring Food Co-op Association employ 1,500 people, and they have some 90,000 members. So you can see if these two organizations are getting together and seeing and exploring what they can do together, how much more powerful the organization can be. And so that's what's happening in Western New England. And that kind of thing is happening all over the place. They took examples from Italy and from Spain, where we have associations of cooperatives across sector that really are competitive with capitalist economies.
Right. So one of the things that you point out in the book is just the lack of visibility for cooperatives. And I guess that's one of the functions of the Valley Association of Worker Cooperatives is to bring more visibility to the cooperatives in the region. But I think it's also great how the VOC, if that's what you call it, is
yes.
That's a lot easier, is working to actually build up more cooperatives in the area. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, their mission, the three things that they really do are support for their own members, and that includes promotion and
help with purchasing.
Advertising.
Yeah.
Right. And then education is a big part of their mission. And one of the things they're doing with education is not only through promotion, promoting the model and the businesses of each member co-op, but also working with the University of Massachusetts to educate students in the region as well. And they've created an amazing program at the University of Massachusetts. It's called the University of Massachusetts Cooperative Enterprise Collaborative. And it's the first program in the U.S. that has been co-produced with a group of cooperatives. And recently, the director of the Neighboring Food Co-op Association taught an introductory level class on cooperatives. And this is really unusual because the fields of economics and business have all but ignored cooperatives across sectors, especially worker cooperatives in the university school system in this country. So it's really exciting what they've been able to do, and they wouldn't have been able to do it without having gotten together.
Right.
These 10 businesses, they look small, they look vulnerable, but together they command attention.
Right. That's really interesting. I mean, that business school issue is an important one, since, you know, cooperatives don't even use the word profit. You know, they use the word surplus, which is so foreign to American business. Has there been any outreach to the banking cooperatives, the credit unions? Because it seems like capital is always a big problem, and if there is some kind of alliance between the credit unions and these regional networks, that might be pretty powerful too.
Yeah, definitely. UMass 5 College Credit Union in the same region has been extremely open to this kind of alliance, and they've actually partnered with the food cooperatives and the worker cooperatives to help form the Valley Cooperative Business Association, which is a cross-sector association of cooperatives and cooperative associations in the Valley, in the Connecticut River Valley. And you can learn more about that it is vcba.coop. And it's really interesting, if you pull up a map on that website of cooperatives in the Valley, you can see how much capital, how much power, and the presence of cooperatives in this region. It's quite amazing. It's invisible unless you look.
I like that you use the word power, because throughout the history of co-ops, there's always been a relationship, and I'm going back to the colonial era, relationship between social movements and cooperatives, and I think that power building is really important as something we see. So where can people buy your book, and where can people keep up to date with your work? Is there a website you recommend for that?
Yes. I have a blog, but also there's the GEO, the Grassroots Economic Organizing website.
Sure.
You can always check it in. There'll be news of the book there. My blog is jtcornwell.com. And also, you can purchase the book at Levelers Press. The telephone number is 413-992-7408. Or contact by email, levelerspress1@gmail.com. There will be a website for the book soon, but it's not up yet.
Very good.
Great. Well, thank you for co-authoring that book and for the work that you do and taking time to speak with us this morning. We'll put all of these websites and the information about how to get the book on our website, clearingthefogradio.org. And so thanks again for joining us. We're going to, in the next segment, Ajua Ndinga Fatayo, also from Grassroots Economic Organizing, is going to join us to talk more specifically about some of these models around the world. So thank you again, Janelle.
Thank you, Margaret and Kevin. Have a good day. Thanks so much. Right.
Okay. Thanks. And we're going to go into this break with a song called The Cooperative Legacy Song by Adrian Wright.
Has been faced with social injustice, economic chaos way back before the days of Egyptian pharaohs. Search for ways to alleviate the stress by a group consensus, pooling resources. Often they practice numerous methods, sharecropping, swap labor, bartering system. That was an era of trial and error, till the winds of change brought the industrial era. Since then, technology has been forcefully advancing, therefore, new methods were urgently needed.
You're listening to We Act Radio, WPWC, 1480 AM. Visit us online at weactradio.com.
Yeah, a cooperative represents unity. A cooperative represents the community. A cooperative benefits you and me academically, financially. A cooperative gives back to society, employment opportunity, reduce poverty. A cooperative elevates the economy, a better country for you and me.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeese, and we're talking about cooperatives, as that last song kind of indicated.
That's right. We're talking about creating cooperative economies. And our next guest is Ajua Ndinga Fatayo. She's the co-editor of Grassroots Economic Organizing and co-founder of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. She assists cooperatives as a technical advisor and has co-founded an affordable housing co-op, the Ella Jo Baker Cooperative Community in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And we appreciate the work that you do. So we went into a little bit of the basics of cooperatives with Janelle Cornwell on the first segment, and now we'd really like to talk about kind of this, what's happening nationally and globally with creating these cooperative communities, and you've really been at a center of a lot of that. I was wondering if you could talk first with our guests about the Mondragon model in Spain. We didn't get a chance to go into that.
Yes. Mondragon is the world's largest grouping or a complex of cooperatives. They started out with a Catholic priest started a school because the Basque people in Mondragon weren't allowed to speak their language. And so the priest, Father Aris Mending, started a school so that the Basque people could speak their language. And from there, they went on to form first engineering co-op, and now they have 120 cooperatives that include grocery stores, credit unions, insurance companies, stores, all kinds of cooperatives and other businesses that help people with jobs and other projects. One of those is called Seolan, which is an organization that is not a cooperative but started by Mondragon to help entrepreneurs to start businesses, you know, help them with their ideas and get them off the ground. And they could start a co-op or they could start a sole proprietorship. So it is one of the models that people in this country and in countries all over the world use to know that it's possible and to see the kinds of things that cooperatives can do.
So what are some of the key lessons, you think, of that experience? We're in this moment in the United States where you're seeing this kind of a growth of cooperatives and interest in cooperatives, people owning their own work and controlling their own destiny. What do you think some of the key lessons from Mondragon are that we can use at this point in our history of development of cooperatives?
Well, one of those key lessons was to persevere. it wasn't easy. And so they did all kinds of things under the Franco regime to make sure that they could start a co-op. And they did stuff like have people contribute, you know, people in the community contributed, you know, $5 or whatever they could to help form the cooperatives. And so in this country where money is, you know, always a problem, that is a lesson that we have to learn. If a community is needing a particular business such as daycare or even a grocery store, the community must begin to see it as in their interest to have that business. And so even if it's just a dollar or $5, the community can contribute to people having the finances to start the cooperative as well as support the cooperative in other ways. Another lesson learned was that democratic management. The workers over there managed the businesses. Right. When I went over there, I was able to, that was in 2011, at one of the Fagor cooperatives that build appliances, there were little teams, you know, like five people. And so they did everything in the business. They did the inventory, they did safety checks, they actually built the appliance. They did everything. They handled their personnel if someone was absent. They covered for them. It was an amazing thing to see. But in this country, we as workers are told and we're made to feel that we can't do these things. So that's one lesson. And another one is that labor is primary. In this country, we're taught that capital, money, is primary, and that the money, the labor, we as the workers serve the money. But in Mondragon, they have a different understanding that money serves the workers, and so that is the key component in terms of the principle that they use to guide them. So just because you have a lot of money, doesn't mean that you get to control everything.
Right.
And so it's there's a lot of good lessons with Mondragon, and it's an amazing thing to see. And I think in this country we just need to try to get started with two or three people, like they did. And I think they had five people when they started their first engineering cooperative.
Isn't that amazing? So, just a few people can start this dramatic shift in a whole region's economy. Just a
absolutely.
Few people. It's a fantastic lesson.
Yeah, and I think that I just want to reiterate the point that you made, because it's one that people in the United States don't hear. And we were talking earlier about how kind of economics courses and business in the U.S. doesn't teach the cooperative model. And it's such an important and growing model, is that money is not the bottom line. The bottom line is the people in the
right.
in the cooperative economy. And that's so important. Dan, did Mondragon, were they the ones that pioneered the reinvestment, that taking a portion of the money that is made and reinvesting it so that you can build more cooperatives?
Well, I believe that they had a situation where they invested in, you know, put money back into the community and started funding cultural events and stuff like that. But Emilia Romagna is the one that actually made it a structure in terms of cooperatives contributing 3% of their profit to a fund that would help other cooperatives get started and build a regional network. And so that's something that I think in this country we could probably try to institute as well.
Yeah, I think that's an important lesson, because one of the big problems with getting cooperatives going is resources, is funding. And in the United States. And I was wondering, you know, credit unions are cooperatives. And how is the relationship between the credit union association and their movement with the cooperative movement in the United States? Is there much of a relationship there, or is there, what's your thoughts on that?
It's a very slight relationship. I think it could be stronger. At one point, I believe credit unions were not allowed to loan money to businesses, but I believe that's changed now.
Right, so a certain percentage they can lend a certain percentage of their money to businesses now. Yeah.
Right. So I think we need to build a stronger relationship so that people could, you know, use credit unions to build, like, if they're getting some social services, some business and foundations will fund the seed money that each person in a cooperative has to contribute. You know, if you start a cooperative, it may be $500 or $2,000 per member to invest so that the cooperative gets off the ground. With some foundations, will help poor people with that money. They call it an IDA, Individual Development Account. And so the credit unions have and could do more of lending that person's that money so that they can make their financial contribution to the cooperative and probably do some more business lending. It's something that I think that the movement needs to work on developing much more.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, in Mondragon, you know, Spain has been under some severe economic pressure and austerity measures there. How has the Basque region under Mondragon compared to the rest of Spain economically right now?
Well, when I was over there in 2011, they were doing much better than anybody around them and in Europe in general. Their losses weren't as high. They had some losses, but they weren't as high. They were able to maintain all of their cooperatives. And one of the good things about them, like, even if a cooperative was doing badly and had to close or shut down temporarily, what they would do was retrain those people so that they would get jobs in other cooperatives, which was really great. Now, just recently, Fagor apparently closed down, and so that indication that things got a little worse. But I think they're still overall doing much better than a lot of capitalist corporations.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we see as well. And I think it's so key that, you know, times change and businesses are going to change. And so if you have a model that makes sure that even as things change, you can retrain and rehire workers, I think that's...
So we need to take a break.
Yep, that's right. Sorry.
when we come back, I want to talk more about what the challenges of co-ops in the United States are, what the opportunities are, and how we can actually build a cooperative economy rather than a more that's dominated by cooperatives rather than one dominated by capitalism. So I hope we can talk about those kind of issues and come back.
And we're going to go into this break with a song by Jefferson Airplane called Solidarity.
So it feeds us all forever. See to it that it's now yours. Forward, without forgetting, where our strength can be seen now to be.
You're listening to We Act Radio, WPWC 1480 AM. Broadcasting live from Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue in D.C.
When starving or when eating, it's forward, not forgetting our solidarity.
You are listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeis.
We're talking about creating cooperative economies, and our guest right now is Ajua Nzinga Ifetayo, and her biography is on our website, clearingthefogradio.org.
Let's get into what's going on in the United States. We see so much discussion of cooperatives at the urban level around the country, and people seem to be wanting to start new cooperatives. Let's start with the challenges. I mean, you've been involved as a board member of cooperatives, a technical advisor, and have helped to start up some cooperatives yourself. What are some of the challenges cooperatives face in getting going?
Well, you know, one of the biggest ones I always like to say is education and rethinking and retraining ourselves as individuals. We're taught so much to be individualistic in this society and only to care about ourselves or our families. And in thinking cooperatively, we have to begin to think of the good of the whole, not only in our families and our lives, but in the whole economy and the whole world. And that takes a lot of retraining. You'll get in the cooperative and often people will think it's a great idea and they're rah, 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 they're ready to work. But when it comes down to maybe giving a little bit more time or maybe sacrificing something, people just tend to fall back into old behavior. And so, sometimes people get a little selfish. And so we need to work on developing ways to counteract the conditioning that we get on a daily basis to say that we shouldn't care about our neighbors or other people's children or anything like that. And so that's one big area. And then the other one is actual education. We don't know what cooperatives are. We've been deliberately kept ignorant in this country about another form of economic organization. Right. So we need to learn about cooperatives and what they can do and their benefits. And then on top of that, we need to learn different skills in terms of how to run a cooperative, how to run meetings, how to keep books, how to market, all those business things that we need. It's not an insurmountable obstacle, but it takes some time, and it's going to take some commitment. And not everybody can do that. And we always say that cooperatives are not for everybody because some of us don't want to make those kind of commitments. But if you are hungry enough, if you feel like we can change the world, with cooperatives, that it would save the earth, then I think that you would have the energy and excitement to put in the hours, to learn, to teach, to participate when you're not even sure what you feel or should think. But you'll have the passion to do it. So I really think that more than money is that the whole education of the individual, in terms of the way we think, and then that the critical information that we need to run cooperatives is more important than money.
That's so interesting. I think there's a lot of truth in that, and I think a lot of, almost everyone you talk to in the co-op movement really starts with education as always the top thing that is needed is education on how cooperatives work, how to run a business in a cooperative way, and how it fits into the community. Now, cooperatives have been around a long time in the United States. I mean, this is not a new concept. You can go back to the pre-revolutionary period in the colonial era and find cooperatives. You can even find it among indigenous Native Indians. So this is a long history. Why has it been so that cooperatives have not become the dominant form of economy? And is there something that in the future can change that so we're not in this dog-eat-dog capitalist system, but much more in a system of working together to solve problems in a community and cooperative type way?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the economic Godzilla that we live under here. It has all of the power make people feel like if you're in a cooperative, you're a communist. So you have a lot of people who are afraid to even say the word because they associate that with being a communist. And then, the economic forces that make it difficult to get money sometimes to start cooperatives. A couple of friends and I, we did work for like a year and a half to start a cooperative. We worked out all the plans, what we're going to do, the personnel, everything. But in the end, it was the money that prevented us because we didn't have a backup in terms of, okay, if the business doesn't do well, what will we live off of? And so that's often an issue. In terms of black people, there was violence, you know, by white people when black people started to try to start cooperative businesses. They were attacked. Mm-hmm. And so that's another factor. And then, you know, it's education. We're not taught about cooperatives in school. We don't learn how to live cooperatively with our neighbors. We live next door to people and for years and don't even know who they are. So you know, there are a lot of obstacles. But I think that right now we see the system not meeting a lot of the needs of even middle class people. And that was another thing. You know, a lot of people were able to do pretty well. But now, you know, a lot of people are not able to do that well. Losing jobs, losing pensions, doing work that they don't like to do.
Right.
You know, so we have more of an interest in starting co-ops or finding alternatives. So I think we're starting to see the tide change a bit. So I think we'll probably see a lot. We've already seen that with
we've seen a lot of
Jackson.
That's right.
You know, even Baltimore, the recent conference in Baltimore.
Right.
Other places around the country, people are really getting into economic alternatives, which includes cooperatives and bartering and all kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it is out of really out of necessity, but I hope, you know, and that's what we see. I think there's an excellent book by John Curl, For All the People, where he goes through the history of cooperatives and how they parallel social transformation in the country as well. And so when there are hard times, people come together in their communities, they organize together to solve those problems. I really hope that this time we can make it a more dominant part of our economy.
It's up to us to make that happen.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's another point is that, you know, we talk about the fact that the capitalists have so much power, but the truth is that the people, if we work together, have much more power than the small amount of elites.
Well, that's what's so important about your story about Mondragon beginning with just a few people and developing this massive, massive enterprise. And, you know, so much starts with just a few people. People need to really not be afraid of their own power and look at the problems in their community and get together and start talking
yeah,
about
you
it.
Know, one or two people who have similar interests, you know, get together and talk about how we can do a business together. It's easier if, you know, you're splitting the money, you're splitting the time to start a business with someone else. And, you know, we organized housing cooperatives, and there were like seven of us who knew each other, and we recruited like eight more people who didn't know each other. And a lot of problems develop out of that. So sometimes it's good to start with people you know, people who, you know, you understand their process and what they can do and all those things. And so I think you might have a chance to be a little bit more successful.
Yeah, I think, and trust has to be a huge part of this.
Absolutely.
As well. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So in the last few minutes, unless there's something specifically that you think is more important to talk about, I was wondering if you could talk about the new U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, what that does and how it fits into the broader picture.
Oh, yeah, sure. The U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives is a group of all the worker cooperatives in the country. Well, actually, it includes some developers and others who are not necessarily a worker co-op, but you know, want to align with worker co-ops. And so what it's done is it's brought together people who are doing this work so that they could support each other, have a conference every other year to learn new information so that you can take that information and go back to your communities and run cooperatives or start them. And another thing that it does is to foster regional cooperative federations or associations so that the cooperative principle of doing business with cooperatives can be practiced. Say if in D.C. we had, you know, a store where we want to buy our goods from farmers who, you know, have a CSA or a cooperative understanding. We want to buy our paper from another co-op. We want to bank at the credit union. You know, we want to spread our dollars among other people who are doing cooperatives. And so the U.S. Federation is the organization that is helping people to do that. And one of the things that they're also working on is education, technical assistance, and even allowing small cooperatives to be able to afford insurance so that their workers could have the same benefits as a traditional job. And there's one other thing I do want to mention is Jessica Gordon-Nemhart wrote a book on black cooperatives called Collective Courage.
Right.
And so that gives a good history that everybody can use in terms of, you know, what people did, how they did it, and some of the things that we can learn from that.
Yeah, people told her there was no history of black cooperatives in the country, and then she actually looked into it. There's a kind of a pretty deep, rich history, and a lot of it's in Baltimore. Baltimore has had a big cooperative movement for a long time.
Right, those ship dock workers comes to mind immediately.
Right, well, right. Is there a particular website or websites where our listeners can follow your work?
Not my work, but the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops. Well, actually, I could give you GEO, which I work with. That's GEO.coop, C-O-O-P. And then the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives is USWorker.coop, C-O-O-P. And then East.USWorkers.coop is for the Eastern Conference of Workplace Democracy, which is the Eastern Regional Co-op Organization. And we're having a conference in Worcester, Mass, in June or July this year. And so if you are interested in starting a co-op, this would be the place to come. And you can get information at east.usworker.coop and learn. Meet other people who are doing it. You may meet somebody who's doing the same kind of cooperative that you want to do, and so you have some immediate assistance there. And so, you know, those things are really helpful to do, and the Federation helps people with that.
Great. Well, thank you for all the work that you do and for taking time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Great. We want to thank Kimon Freeman for being our producer engineer, and we'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire called We Want, because
the people organized
can build the kind of future we want.
The time is 6:57. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Hard Knock Radio is next.
For a quick rundown for those who don't know what astral traveling is.
Jazz. Soul. Funk. Rare grooves. Breaks. Beats. World music. Hand-picked music.
Hosted by DJ Cecily.
Sunday nights.
At 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Radio. Portland, Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio proudly co-sponsors the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on Thursday, July 17th from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison. This fundraiser opens with an ocean art show and silent auction, followed by a screening of the surf film Seven Signs. Then the reggaetronic five-piece band Everyday Profits takes center stage at 10 p.m. Again, that's the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on July 17th. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
Thank you. Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO's Programming Charter. KBOO should be a model of programming, filling needs that other media do not, providing programming to unserved or underserved groups. KBOO shall provide access and training to those communities. KBOO News and Public Affairs Programming shall place an emphasis on providing a forum for unpopular, controversial, or neglected perspectives on important local, national, and international issues, reflecting KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO's arts, cultural, and musical programming shall cover a wide spectrum of expression from traditional to experimental, and reflect the diverse cultures we serve. KBOO shall strive for spontaneity and programming excellence, both in content and technique.
And Nicola, you are live on air.
Yes, a kookaburra bird.